Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. Thank you very much for downloading hour number two of Friday's Ben Jarofsky Show. Now, let me tell you about hour number one of Friday's Ben Jarofsky Show. Man, we take the deep dive. Ethics reform with Governor Pritzker. Do not use the word ethics or reform in anything having to do with Illinois politics. That's sort of the theme. Hillary and Howard. What's that all about? Hillary Clinton was on the Howard Stern Show. We talk about Hillary's ongoing, what is it, D? Her attitude about Bernie Sanders. Come on, Hillary, show some love for Bernie. A clarification on a reefer policy. Lori goes to Iowa, so we sort of investigate Lori's interviewing skills because she's going to be interviewing Mayor Pete, Dennis's favorite candidate. And then finally, Ramada Hussein comes in. It's another Ramada Hussein, or Ramada Rundown every Friday. And boy, we take part Eddie Gate. So plenty of good talk. It's hour number one of Friday's Ben Jarofsky Show. Go download it, people.
How did you go from sharing stories over the years to deciding to write a book?
Good question, Mayor. Good question.
Hour number two of your Ben Jarofsky Show for Friday, December 6th, is just moments away. But before we get into hour number two, we need to thank the following unions for jumping on board and sponsoring this program. First up, it's the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local 126 and District 8, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 9, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150. And of course, today's Ben Jarofsky Show is brought to you in part by our good friends at the Chicago Federation of Labor. Hour number two, let's go. Friday, December 6th, and live from the Chicago Sun-Times Chicago Reader Studio on Racine Avenue, this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. In this hour of the program, our neighborhood Chicago preservationist Andrew Schneider returns, and it's all things Democratic and Illinois politics with Illinois political know-it-all Jacob Kaplan. And now your host, yes, also a Chicago political know-it-all, Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Jacob Kaplan will be in the studio. Andrew Schneider is in the studio. Fans of the political know-it-alls, don't be too disappointed. Young Daniel Pogoshelsky will not be in the studio. He's in Paris. Did not know that. Young Daniel is really a globetrotter, but I'd already booked Jacob. Jacob's come on. We're going to talk all things politics. Andrew Schneider will be here talking all things preservation and politics. We're going to force him here to stay when Jacob's here. We'll talk some political stuff. Andrew's got a lot to say about everything, and so he's not afraid to take the deep dive, D. All right? Okay.
Good.
You can learn from Andrew Schneider. Before we
are you saying I'm afraid to take the deep dive?
No. Did I say that? Happen. So what's the update, Jacob? Have for me, young man.
I love swimming. Okay. We may have a City Club Gate update. I'm waiting for the details to develop, waiting for it to come up on Sun Times.
Hold on. Let me get my certificate.
Yeah, get your certificate
this.
Out. I believe we're going to have a City Club Gate update. But in the meantime, mm-hmm. Ben, someone reached out to us on the Ben Jarofsky Show Facebook page.
Okay.
And I had a feeling this was going to happen after yesterday's show.
I had a feeling.
Okay. All right. Please stop singing. Okay. Ricky reached out on the Ben Jarofsky Show Facebook page. Ricky, what's happening up top? My man. All right, cool. Ricky says here, I watched Thursday's show, 12/5, 2019. You had an alderman on, Nick Spezzato, a Trump supporter. I feel you should not have been so easy on this dude. His support, he said, was based on the economy. What BS? But he didn't say BS, all right? What BS? With everything awful Trump has done to this country, I wish you would have been more forceful in your responses. Ben, I love your show and will contribute to be a fan, or I will continue to be a fan of you.
You can contribute as well.
Oh, you can contribute as well, yeah.
We can do both.
Give me $5, Ricky.
Ricky raises some good points, but continue, yeah.
Ben, I love your show and will continue to be a fan of you and Dr. D. Oh, that was nice. Let's see here. I was devastated when that station that shall not be named gave you the old heave-ho.
Well, I can't remember the name of the station either.
That's WCPT 820. Where's your guys' memory at?
Oh, I don't know.
They fired you.
Well, I think he remembered. He just wouldn't name it. I just can't remember it. Oh. I just forgot it already.
What do you have to say to Rick?
Well, I have to say, I thought about this. Should I bring a Trump supporter on the show? Andrew Schneider is sitting here thinking about this. I'm going to put the ball in his court and ask him what he thinks. But I'm going to tell you what I think. I've known Nick for a long time. I knew him when he was a firefighter before he was an alderman. I respect where he came from as an independent running against the Democratic machine. Rick, for many years, you may not know this about me because you just probably, I don't know if this is true, but a lot of people who've heard me as a radio personality don't realize I spent like 30 years writing, battling the Democratic machine. So I have a lot of issues with the Democratic machine and the way they ran the city in the 90s and the O's. And I've always respected people like Nick Sposato, who had the guts to take a stand. He ran against the Banks family on the northwest side of Chicago. A lot of guts on Nick Sposato's part. And I met him about, we were talking about this, 2007. When he was first getting started running against the Banks empire. And I respected the fact that he stood with the teachers in 2012. Nick has moved steadily to the right over the last few years. And a lot of people who once supported him won't have anything to do with him anymore. Rick, I just not there. I feel as though there's a lot of good in Nick Sposato. And so part of me wants to hear what he has to say about Donald Trump. Why does he support Donald Trump in the face of everything? I took issue with a lot of the things he said about Donald Trump. I did not address the issue about the economy. You're absolutely correct when you said that. I go, you're right. Because I remember when he said that, he goes, well, the stock market's doing well, as that's a sign of whether the economy is doing well. So I look forward to having more conversations with Nick. I think about this all the time, Rick, because I always say, well, I'm from Biden to Bernie, or even beyond that, because I bring on Green Party people. And a lot of my centrist and, Democrats get upset when I bring Sam Holloway on, for instance, a Green Party supporter who it just won't have anything to do with the Democrats because he thinks they're sellouts and betrayers of all things progressive. And I just think they have valuable things to offer. So when I hear bring Nick Sposato on, let's see what Trump supporter says. Is there something you can learn from Nick Sposato that you could tailor your message to win him over? What would win a Nick Sposato over? At this point, I don't think anything will win a Nick Sposato over, a Nick Sposato Trump supporter over. They seem dead set on supporting Trump, regardless of what Trump does. So sometimes it's important to hear that as well. Some of the stuff, whenever you hear somebody supporting Donald Trump, it is annoying at the very least. It could be infuriating. So I understand. But, we don't bring them on that often. Trump was the last time we had a Trump support. Nick was the last one we had. So anyway, thanks for writing in. Thanks for listening. But I hear you. I remember when Nick said the thing about the economy, I was like going to jump in, but then we went on to another topic and we argued over that. So
there you go, Ricky. Hopefully that answered your question there. And hey, once again, contribute, huh?
Contribute. All right. What'd you contribute?
Give me $5, Ricky. All right, now our City Club Gate update.
Oh, wait.
Ben, briefly, and I mean briefly, just recap everybody on what the City Club Gate is.
Well, I'm going to ask Andrew Schneider, has he ever been to City Club? But no. All right, the City Club is an organization of good citizens from downtown Chicago get together, I don't know, once a month or every other week.
All right, we got the City Club. Now the gate.
The gate part is that the former head of the City Club, Jay Doherty, is a lobbyist and was representing a Commonwealth Edison, and the City Club, the feds came a knocking. on the City Club store.
Freaks me out every time. Don't do that. You're scaring
and,
me.
Looking for, we don't know what they were looking for, but it was obviously in conjunction with an investigation of Commonwealth Edison and Michael Joseph Madigan. And so, son, I had a lot of fun making fun of the City Club, this pristine group of civic citizens who get together to discuss the issues of the day. And like I said, folks, never talk reform when it comes to Illinois and Chicago politics, because even the reformers were the subject of FBI investigators.
So there you go. That's City Club Gate. Ben recently went to a meeting at the City Club of Chicago, and he was given a certificate. That's yes. Awesome, right? Ben, could you read the name of the person who signed that certificate?
Jay Doherty.
Here's our update. Jay Doherty is out as head of the City Club of Chicago.
Oh, man, life is rough.
Ben, I hope no one comes knocking on this door.
Hold on.
Please stop. You're scaring me.
It's Andrew Schneider did it, not
that's,
me.
Hey, it's that's an eBay item right there. That's what I see.
I was, you know what? I said this to Dennis. I go, this is a collector's item. I got Jay Jordy's. But the problem is I had Danny Mahopoulos. Okay, you know, can I just share this with you, Andy? You would know, you're into preservation.
Yes.
2,000 years ago, when I was a young man, I'm not even a young man, a kid, I collected baseball cards, all right? Okay, this is what you're doing in the 60s. I love collecting hundreds of baseball cards. I would dutifully buy baseball cards, open them up, eat the gum. And so I have a Mickey Mantle. Mickey Mantle's one of the greatest baseball players ever, millennials. Baseball card from 1965. And I thought it would be a good idea in about 1968, when I was just sitting around my room, just idly wasting time, to autograph Mickey Mantle.
Yes.
So I autograph a Mickey Mantle baseball card, and then years later I learned, are you kidding me? That thing could be worth the
cost. If you hadn't defaced it.
I hadn't defaced it. I defaced a Mickey Mantle. So anyway.
It's hard. You know what they say in the autograph business is that cold is gold. So you've got the first step here, but you got to wait for Jay Doherty to shuffle off this mortal coil. And then you're going to have something really valuable.
Well, here's the problem. This is why the Mickey Mantle anecdote is relevant. I had Danny Mahopoulos, WBEZ ace investigative reporter, on the show talking about City Club Gate. He had done some of the initial stories that broke the stories, did a great job, as he always does. And so as a joke, I said, Dan, could you autograph my City Club certificate? And so I defaced it.
Again, you haven't learned. You've learned nothing.
I've learned nothing. So you've never been to the city?
No, you know, the only Chicago. I spend most of my time in the neighborhoods. I've sort of a conscientious objector to the downtown area. Apparently, it just sort of fell into that. But the only club events I've ever attended down there. Once went to the Union League. They had Robert Ballard, the oceanographer and the Navy vet, giving a speech about, and I was always fascinated by Robert Ballard and his career and the things he'd done. And so I begged my father-in-law, who was a board of trade guy, and he was a member of the economic club. That was what that one was. And so we all went down there and got into a fight with a parking lot attendant afterwards. It was a magical wow. Evening. The kind of evening you can only have in Chicago's Loop.
So you've never been to the City Club. By the way, do you share my cynicism or skepticism about anything remotely related to reform being connected to the city of Chicago?
Oh, of course. I mean, the reform message, whatever it is, I remember we talked about Nick Blaze, good old Nick Blaze out in the suburbs, the late Nick Blaze. And he, somebody was talking to me about, it was Joe Annunzio, right? So Frank Annunzio's nephew. He was the village attorney in Niles. And
Frank Annunzio, former congressman from the northwest side of Chicago.
Yeah. Go ahead. And Joe Annunzio said, he said a bunch of hilarious things. His career was all pretty much out in the suburbs, and he was very squishy on why he ended up in the suburbs and not in the city. But he said, I always thought the worst thing I could do was ask my uncle, hey, can you get me a job as, sort of assistant secretary for the state of Illinois in charge of toilet paper? He said that just seemed like a dead end career move to me. So he went out to the suburbs, and he said in retrospect, when the problem with Niles, right, Nick Blaze was ushered in 1961 as a reformer, right? He was going to reform there was gambling in town, and there was the contractors were on the village board, and they got all the contracts. And so he said, reform reform. And he said the lesson of Nick Blaze was don't ever believe anyone if the only thing that they say is reform.
Yeah, I'm with Nick Blaze on that one. On that point.
That one point.
I always get very skeptical when anybody in Illinois talks about reform. We were talking about this earlier in conjunction with Governor Pritzker putting together a task force that would be there's something. I can't remember what the task force was about lobbyists or what have you. And it turns out one of the people he put on the task force was a lobbyist, the person that has stepped down. So it's like we have to do an investigation of the Blue Ribbon Commission investigation. It's so Chicago, so Illinois. By the way, Jacob Kaplan has showed up. God bless Jacob Kaplan. I love it when a guest comes early. And he's executive director of the Democratic Party. We're going to have a political conversation with Jacob in a little bit, but we're talking preservation issues. Jacob is also a preservationist geek, so he can join us in this topic as well. So welcome back to the show, Jacob Kaplan. And as I said
Thanks
earlier,
for having me.
People who think of Jacob and young Daniel Pogoshevsky, one more time, young Daniel is in Paris, I believe.
Yeah, he had to jet off and leave us.
Yeah, he had to jet off and leave
typical.
Us.
Right, he wasn't in Poland last time. Last time I tried to reach him, he was in Poland.
Yeah,
so.
he's gotten, it could be a real big shot. All right, Andrew, let's talk a little preservation issues. Number one topic on the agenda, the Thompson Center. I think we may have talked about this the last time we were here.
We've only sort of alluded a couple times to the preservation battle over the Thompson Center. I want to give while we're on the phone, or while I'm here talking about it, shout out to three individuals that are doing really amazing work around that. That's Elizabeth Blasius, who's actually also a member of Logan Square Preservation's board, A.J. LaTrace, who's a former journalist or current journalist, and then Jonathan Solomon, who's a preservationist, used to be at SAIC. They created the James R. Thompson Historical Society, and so I just took their tour yesterday. It's a free tour. It takes about an hour, and they take you through all the publicly accessible spaces in the Thompson Center, and it's a great tour. Really a lot of fun. Talks about the civic and the engagement history of the building. Talks about the reason the building was built in the first place. You talk about preservation. Talk about the Sherman Hotel and the buildings that were on that block that were demolished, and how, of course, they were demolished because they were blighted. And now, of course, the Thompson Center, it's the same exact narrative. The Thompson Center is blighted, too. They made a couple of really salient points. And again, great shout out. If you haven't followed their work, you got to follow the James R. Thompson Center Historical Society.
That's Robert Mueller. He's just weighing in. Yeah.
But they commented in it, and it's wonderful, and it's typical of how messaging is everything in politics and in buildings and in development. And they said, well, the Thompson Center costs $15 million a year. That's what the state pays into it. And boy, that sounds like a lot of money. But they don't also have an accompanying figure of, well, this is really what it costs to maintain a building. And any of us who own a building, whether that's your modest Chicago 2-flat like I own, or a 6-flat or a 10-flat or an office building, understands that buildings take money. They eat money. You got to pay money to keep them up. And so what's the important figure in that would be is if the state decides to offload the Thompson Center, what are they going to pay in rent every single year to house? I mean, they say it's essentially a million square feet of office space. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know Chicago's starting to see the end of their office space boom, but, you know, million square feet of office space in Chicago, that isn't free.
All right. So let's back up for a moment. Folks, this is an old-fashioned real estate fight story, and many of the interests I'm presuming have not emerged. And Andrew, I've done so many stories like this where there's subterranean interest. You don't know really who all the players are in the game are, because we are talking about prime downtown real estate right there. I want to say Randolph and Jacob Randolph
between
and
LaSalle and Clark.
Yeah. right across the street, just north of City Hall. And when was the Thompson Center built?
83.
Completed 85.
Completed 85.
85.
Just like myself.
There you go.
We're just like yourself.
Equal in age.
Year.
Yes.
And nobody's talking
Jacob's
about
Jacob still growing.
Replacing
yeah, right?
him.
More
yes,
Jacob
know,
every
right?
year.
So the move to demolish the Thompson Center is one of these issues that just sort of emerged in the last 4 or 5 years. And I'm always skeptical, Andrew, when stories like this emerge, because I usually think there's some interests, like I said, that are not at the table. So the public is being told it's a waste of money, it's a white elephant, we should get rid of it, we could make more. Now, this property's probably true. I mean, it is take probably out. If you take land that is tax exempt and put it on the tax rolls, you will get, as a city and as a county, tax dollars, property tax dollars, to the Army. So that's the one kernel of the story that's absolutely true.
But is it in a TIF, Ben?
Is it in a... Wow. Damn. That is a great question. If it's in a TIF, the city will not get it for 23 years. I'm not sure if that block of land is in it. There used to be a TIF downtown, the Central Loop TIF, and that expired. So I'm not certain that this land is in the LaSalle TIF. God, I know way too much
about
TIFs.
It could be,
I'd have to look at a map.
I think the problem, when you talk about any sort of public asset, right? I mean, they always trot out, well, I get this with churches, because we're working to save churches in Logan Square. And we hear, invariably, the argument is, oh, it should be back on the tax rolls. This will finally be paying property tax. And nobody ever talks about there's cost that it comes with. The reason that something pays property taxes is because it's also consuming services. Now, yes, the churches consume services, but if you put 10 students into a building, right, you push over something like a church and you build 10 houses on the side of that church, and each one of those houses is a single kid, well, that's, I'm just back of the napkin math, that's $70,000 that CPS is going to spend if you put those kids in CPS, and that's an annual cost. Is the property tax going to pay for the cost of the services that's going to be consumed by those residences? But nobody ever brings up the cost side of these developments. They only bring up the revenue side, as if that's the whole story.
Well, I just got to tell you, and you, this was one of my favorite themes of Lincoln Yards, the Lincoln Yards fight. Absolutely, to your point, nobody talked about the increased cost of creating a whole new community of people in an area that's largely undeveloped right now, vacant land or old industrial land. You're going to build a whole new community. You're going to have police, fire, teachers, etc. It's just going to be a public cost to that. And you're absolutely correct. And nobody talks about that. They say, oh, hey, the tax dollars that we're going to get.
It's gold. It's going to just flow right in. We get all the money. We're all going to dine out on this. I think the more stunning and terrible story when it comes to that sort of thing is in TIF is Lathrop Homes. Because Lathrop Homes was TIFed with a value of zero, which means that Lathrop Homes, unlike Lincoln Yards, at least Lincoln Yards is going to be paying something in tax to the general funds of CPS and the city and others.
Yes. Can I make please? A brief correction? I hate to do this.
Oh, that's fine.
I know I'm TIF geek number 101.
Fine.
There a good chunk of Lincoln Yards, which is literally right across the street from the Hideout Bar, which I know so well because I go there once a month for First Tuesday, is an old Chicago
the Fleet Facilities Management.
Center. So it paid zero in property taxes. And when that TIF was created, that means that from here on out, all the money that the owner of that land, and I believe it's Sterling Bay, will be paying to the TIF. So that's Exhibit A of exactly what you were talking
about. Well, precisely. And if you want to talk about that, which I think about a great deal, but I'm also a TIF geek, so we got to be careful about going too far down the rabbit hole here.
Two TIF geeks.
But when you look at the Fleet and Facilities Management, and we look at the fact that Lincoln Yards as a whole wasn't eligible, if a month had gone by, it would no longer be eligible as blighted. I haven't gotten a straight answer yet as to whether or not, when they're talking about lagging growth in property values, the way that they evaluate that is based on EAV. And so if they have the Fleet and Facilities Management in that calculation, that's going to drag down
Absolutely.
The average. So I think that the question is whether it was ever eligible to be considered as blighted.
All right, here we went. We're now in TIF geekdom land. But folks, let me tell you something. One, I talk about the TIF scam in so many dimensions because it's a huge scam. But one of the scams is the way they draw a TIF map. A TIF map is intentionally drawn in order to maximize the amount of money that will flow into the TIF bank account. And so what they'll do is the boundaries will exclude. So you could have a vacant land, a vacant lot across the street from a big office building. And so the office building's presence undercuts the notion that the area needs a subsidy because somehow or other that office building got built without the subsidy. But the TIF boundary will go around the office building because that lowers the amount of the value of the land in the TIF. That means more money will pour into it. So you're absolutely correct. By the way, I don't believe anybody when they talk about reform and ethics in Illinois. Don't believe anybody when they talk about blight and preservation.
No, it's a non, that is a non-issue. Blight is opportunity to a certain extent, right? You talk about an old, that you might consider a building old and dilapidated. That sounds like cheap to me. Mm-hmm. And what that generally has meant is, and particularly in Logan Square, storefronts are cheap. Logan Square is ground zero for so many great and creative independent restaurants and businesses, and not just restaurants, but small businesses like Play, the toy store that's just a couple blocks down from my house, right? And they can afford to move into Logan Square because the rent is low, right? If it, Class A office space, brand new construction office space, is $65 a square foot per year, no independent business can afford that. So what do you get? You get doctors and dentists. You get AT&T, the great, you know, and mighty AT&T.
Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
All the chains.
And all the wonderful the touchstones of suburban American life.
Yeah, changing the city's landscape. All right, so let's talk about, in your opinion, and either one of you, what are the virtues?
Before we go, I want to just mention one quick thing about blight. And you mentioned TIF, right? And I can't get this out to enough people. I keep trying to tell people this. Chicagoans and TIF, it's almost like Stockholm Syndrome. Right, because we talk about TIF dollars as being dollars that are available to be spent as they come in, but the fact and that a place that has a TIF that has no money in it is somehow a problem, right? That TIF, we don't have any money to spend on it because the property value hasn't gone up. There's no increment. There's no tax dollars there. But that in and of itself, on its face, is an indication that the TIF program is a lie, because if the TIF is supposed to only be created in places where nothing will happen but for the TIF. So if property values are rising,
yeah,
how on earth does it qualify? Now then you look at another piece of property, another TIF district, someplace like, you know, in Englewood or whatever, and you say, hey, this TIF just hasn't created, the values are going down, they're stagnating, they're not going up. That's evidence that the TIF is actually needed and that the municipality should invest money in that place. Instead, what we do is we go, oh, no, there's incremental growth in the property, and so now we have money to spend. It's like, but then the TIF shouldn't exist in the first place. Yeah. It fails the very first test. And we've all been hit over the head so many times with the TIF idea that we're all just like, oh no, of course, right? Well, there's no money to spend.
Yeah, you got me going. We were here to talk preservation. You were the one, Andrew.
I'm sorry,
I
couldn't help it.
No, it is a scam on so many levels, and so when we get to the other word that no one should believe when they hear people talk about in terms of Illinois and Chicago is transparency. And so if we're going to abide by the principle of transparency, then one of the first things we should be transparent about is a program that's intended largely to eradicate blight in the poorest communities, but is in fact subsidizing development in the most rapidly gentrifying communities. So let's just be honest about the freaking program.
That's right. All it's done is balkanize the city. It's done what generations of powerful in Chicago have wanted, which is find a way to keep tax dollars generated in wealthy communities in those communities, and then to sort of look at the rest of us and go, oh no, Lincoln Yards, they're going to create this tax revenue, so we should keep it here. They're only getting the benefit of their own money, as if the city as a whole isn't intended to be a mechanism that delivers equity across the entire place.
All right, now you were the one who got us in service. Sure. I'm trying to go back to Thompson Center.
Let's go back to Thompson Center.
What are the virtues of the Thompson Center? Let's just put aside the notion, the whole issue of how much money will remain, raise if we get rid of the Thompson Center and put it to a developer, private developer, or a private landlord. Put that aside for the moment. What are the virtues from a landmark preservationist point of view that you would advocate to the larger public to convince them that this building is worth preserving, and either one of you can answer.
I mean, I think it's one of the most iconic and unique buildings of the 1980s, of postmodern architecture. I think if you see that building on the cover of so many architectural guidebooks of not just Chicago, but world modern architecture of the late 20th century. I mean, it is one of the iconic buildings of its era. And I think it's a testament to its uniqueness that still to this day, you see people walking into that atrium and just they're in awe of the space. Whether they're tourists or they're locals or anybody, it's an incredible space. It's an amazing building. And any building that even, you know, the average Joe off the street can walk into and see this is an incredible space, I think, is worth preserving. And it's also, you know, it's a public building that anybody can walk into and see is the other important thing. This is owned by the public. It's owned by us. So I think the idea that it's just going to be demolished for a private development or something like that, I don't know, I find it pretty distasteful.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, if you go through the atrium level of the Thompson Center, you'll see signs that say things like, no loitering, no this or that or the other. But in truth, people loiter like crazy. There's a food court in there, right? They can bring their own lunch. They can just come in and gawk, right? They can come in and enjoy. They can come in and get a little sun in the cold months and be in a semi-climate controlled sort of space. And I think that that's the great virtue of the Thompson Center. It's a public space. It's an indoor public space that everyone shares. Aside from its architectural virtues that Jacob was extolling. Those are the things. And look, not only that, but all of the marvelous public protests and acts of protest that have the Thompson Center has been a backdrop for so many things. It's a really important space. I'm going to shout out to the Thompson Center Historical Society folks, A.G. LaTrace, Elizabeth Blasius, and Jonathan Solomon. They ran a marvelous tour, and in the process of that, they said, look, you know, this is a space where people have protested apartheid. They've protested. They showed up to the teachers union strike more recently here. This is a space that is a shared public space that everyone can access. That is with the one exception of the elevators, which post 9/11 they sort of roped off the immediate area around the elevators. But other than that, it's an important space for the history, the 20th century, late 20th century history of the city of Chicago, and we shouldn't do away with it.
All right. My memory, and help me out here, my memory is always faulty, is that the movement to sell the Thompson Center was particularly strong during the Rauner years. And so how strong is that movement right now?
Well, I think it's never been stronger, right? The Rauner, you know, floated it, and it got no traction in part because we can go back to Lincoln Yards on this, but the value of the piece of property is a function not only of what's built there, but what may be built there. And so we remember famously Rahm Emanuel was holding up, oh no, I'm never going to allow a super towel on this site. I'm never going to allow, and there was some horse trading going on, right? And so now that we have a Democratic governor in J.B. Pritzker, we've got a, you know, Democratic mayor in Lori Lightfoot, everybody's sort of potentially on the same team. They all need one another for things, and we have an authorization from the state legislature to actually go ahead and sell the Thompson Center. The budget includes
money.
Funding coming out of a sale of the Thompson Center. So I think that, you know, the Thompson Center's never been more in jeopardy than it is right now.
And have we begun the public process of soliciting bids, that kind of thing?
I think sort of, but there's the public process. It's not like in historic preservation, if you have a property that's listed on the National Register, which I don't believe the Thompson Center is, there's a process called Section 106 where you have to go through impact, right? Historic impact and what's going to happen, what's going to be lost if this building is demolished, sold, changed. There is a similar process because this is a public building, right? So there will be a lengthy process about evaluating proposals and ideas to sell the Thompson Center. So there's going to be plenty of public input. But as somebody who's participated in many, many, many public processes, I can tell you that half the time those are a dog and pony show. And so the decision's been made already. It doesn't matter how many times members of the public, preservationists, or just people that are fiscally concerned show up, the decision's been made.
And, you know, the one thing I would love somebody to do, and, you know, the great thing about the Thompson Center is you have all the state offices, for the most part, under one roof in Chicago.
Yeah.
And the state actually in recent years, partially because government has been so shrunk under the Rauner, you know, years when funding for everything was impacted. But we've gotten rid of the leased office space in a lot of the downtown loop. So it's pretty much all in the Thompson Center now. All the state offices are there or in the Bolandic building across the street. The state claims they can move all of the state offices, I believe, into the Bolandic building if the Thompson Center is closed. But I just question how that's going to work. And if it's not true, and it might not be, if we have to start leasing space, has anybody done like a cost analysis of how much it's going to cost over the years compared to just rehabbing the Thompson Center and maintaining it properly? I haven't seen anybody do that sort of research.
And I think that broadly speaking, I just object to any sort of sale of a public asset. If there's one thing now, real estate goes up and down in value over you know, in fits and starts, but over the long haul, acquiring a building like the Thompson Center, whether through lease or buying it later because we decide we need it, it just gets more expensive over time. So we've got a public asset now. It's in the public sphere. There's no tax revenue flowing out of the Thompson Center that anybody's counting on. Why? And we need the office space. There's a demonstrated need for the space. Why on earth would we close it? What's the plan, to Jacob's point, what's the plan to replace those that space elsewhere in the loop or elsewhere? It just doesn't make any sense to surrender a public asset for private development, especially when they float figures, $300 million. Again, the Thompson Center Historical Society folks done marvelous work, and they're looking at this going, that's a huge amount of money, $300 million.
What's the $300 million?
That's the figure that's been tossed around, that the Thompson Center could net $250 to $300 million in a sale. But that's a huge amount of money. I mean, it's not, and A.J. LaTrace was pointing this out, that's on the scale of a mega development, $300 million, because then there's demolition cost, and then so now you're into it, $320 million, and what have you got for it? You've got something slightly larger than the hole that it was the spire.
So
right?
I want to be clear what you're getting at. When you say it's a huge amount of money, do you think they're inflating the amount of money that they could?
I think that's an illusory figure, and I think that my father-in-law used to say this. He'd go into real estate openings and say, "How much you want for the house?" And they'd say $800,000. And he says, "Well, I'll give you $200,000." And they say it's worth $8 million. And he goes, "Well, who else has bid? Right now, it's worth $200,000." Yeah. And the answer is, until somebody steps up and says, "Yeah, I'll pay $300 million for the Thompson Center," that's just a figure that somebody invented to make it look good. Right? Selling the Thompson Center is good. We can get a lot of money, guys. But I haven't seen that. Have you seen the giant check?
So your concern is that the amount that's floated around has been exaggerated, and it does not reflect, even if it is exaggerated, the amount of money it would cost to demolish the Thompson Center. You're assuming that if there's a sale, demolition costs would come out of the sale price. So in other words, if you sell the building, let's say we sell the Thompson Center, the state, to Dennis, Dr. D over there, for $300 million, you're assuming...
Well, he bought Ballast Point last week.
Yeah, so he's got a lot of money.
Loaded.
So let's say he buys it. So you're assuming that Dennis would not be covering the demolition costs, that in fact that demolition costs would come out of the $300 million.
The answer is that whatever price is paid for the Thompson Center is going to reflect what the developer has to service that, plus whatever money goes into the construction of the new building. So the new building has to pay for, what did the Sears Tower sell for? The Willis Tower. Wasn't that $175 million?
Sounds about right.
Is that what it was? So $175 million buys the Willis Tower, I could be mistaken on that figure, but that is a similarly sized, it's a super tall building, it's on a full city block, and that's an existing building. So now they're saying that this is a better location, right? It is the center of the city, you got all this transit hub under there, it's a very valuable site, but what they're saying is that whatever is built there ultimately is worth $300 million in acquisition, plus whatever it costs to demolish, plus whatever it costs to build this new super tall. So, I mean, what are we looking at? A billion dollar development? I mean, I'm just really, really skeptical. And I'm not, I'm no genius, but I'm really skeptical that kind of money is out there to demolish the Thompson Center. And I really don't think that it's worth the idea of funding. I mean, how much, look, if it's $15 million a year, right, that we're going to have to spend to keep up that building. Isn't that what we're probably going to spend in rent and costs elsewhere? Like, why not simply keep the building?
Yeah, no, I you're making some very compelling points. And again, my skeptical assumption, born from many years of covering these things, is that the decision to sell the Thompson Building, develop land, is not a dollar and cents decision intended to protect taxpayers, the fiduciary interests of taxpayers. That's why I keep saying, whenever you get into a land fight in the city of Chicago, you have to look for the subterranean interests at play. I have no idea who they are. They've not emerged. It could just be
the city club.
You missed that part of the conversation, Jacob Kaplan. I have this valuable city club, what is this, certificate, because they invited me. Apparently nobody else would show up that month, so they invited me. Hey, let's invite Ben. Let's get the commie in here, all right? So as part of it, have you ever been to the city club?
I've been to, many events there.
But have you ever been a speaker?
Never been a speaker.
All right, if you're a speaker.
Smart man.
Yeah, you get a certificate, and they signed by Jay Doherty, who just had to step down.
That's going to be a collector's item.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. Except I, in my foolishness, I had Dan Mahopoulos, who broke the story about Citygate, sign it. So now it's, you know.
Well, it might be worth more now.
Yeah, come on. That's true.
Yeah.
No other City Club certificate has Jay Doherty's name and Danny Mahopoulos.
There you go.
That's Jacob Kaplan. And we're going to take a break. We come back. We're going to take a deep dive in all things politics. Andrew Schneider will stick around, too. Guy's got something to say about politics. Young Jacob will be talking politics when we return.
The Ben Jarofsky Show is supported by Northwestern University's part-time master's program in literature and liberal studies. Students learn from dynamic and diverse faculty as they build advanced skills for critical analysis, writing, and research. Evening classes are held on Northwestern's Evanston and Chicago campuses. The spring quarter application deadline is January 15th. Learn more at sps.northwestern.edu/masters.
Read the Chicago Reader to get up to speed on what's what in Chicago. Culture, food, arts and entertainment, weekly concert listings, weekly event listings, the environment, travel. I can continue, but you get the point. And for all of you Chicago political junkies, raw weekly columns on real city politics from Maya Dukmasova and our very own Ben Jarofsky. The Chicago Reader, free to the public in newsstands throughout the city and online at chicagoreader.com. Read it now and be a more informed Chicagoan.
Hey, that commercial break's done. Welcome back to the Ben Jarofsky Show, live from the Chicago Sun-Times.
Kaplan in the studio, executive director of the Cook County Democratic Party, Andrew Schneider. Preservation is extraordinary. We're going to, as I said, we're shifting gears. We're going to stop talking preservation and take the dive into politics. But I'm telling you right now, folks, I'm just getting started in this Thompson Center story. We'll probably bring some Thompson Center preservationist activists on to, in a little while, to, in a couple of weeks, to talk more about it. Because, you know, this just brings together so many things that I'm... And by the way, that the TIF angle, I'm going to check and see if it's in a TIF district. Because if it is in a TIF district, guarantee you, folks... You're not going to get the property tax dollars. They're going to go to the TIF district, and they'll probably use it to spend it on the Thompson Center. You got to keep your eyes open, folks. Can't just believe everything that a public official tells you. Young D, you got an update for me?
Absolutely, I do. I want to remind everyone one thing. Wait, hold on. What's that? Oh, sorry. During the last segment on our show, it looks like our nerd meter went off. Holy cow! These meter readings are through the roof! Man, you guys are nerds!
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Whoa, look at that!
The nerd meter. Oh, man. First time we ever activated the nerd meter alarm.
Holy cow, that's a first, boys. Yeah. Oh, man. History made on the Ben Jarofsky Show. Anyway.
I sent those off everywhere.
We'd like to remind everyone watching us on Facebook Live that on Tuesday, we will be going back to YouTube. All right, no more Zuckerberg. Free ride's over, pal. We hope that those of you who haven't yet, go subscribe to the Sun-Times YouTube channel and come along with us on Tuesday on YouTube. I'm talking to you, Rosemarie, on the Facebook live chat. We see you there. Join us live on YouTube Tuesday. Who knows what shady news will happen between now and then, but I'm sure we'll be covering it. Shout out to our dear friend Babbers on the Facebook live stream, by the way. He's educating the people on what a puma is this afternoon. Ben Jarofsky. For 10 trivia points, what is a P-U-M-A puma?
Puma, isn't that an animal?
I mean, I think it's shoes, right? It's their shoes.
Yeah.
No, but the P-U-M-A stands for something.
A Plan Unit Manufacturing Association.
Holy crap.
I'm nerdy.
Am I right?
No, you're not. So that's pretty good.
Animal, shoe.
And nerd meter's going off again with that thing. Thanks to Babbers, he let us all know. A puma. Well, I got to search for it here. Hang tight. What?
Ben, stall. Okay, I'm waiting. What puma means? Puma animal. I think Derek Rose has a puma contract with the.
Okay,
issue.
Done stalling. Party unity, my ass.
Puma. Okay. Nice. Oh yeah, folks, I'll be writing about this. This is on my mind ever since. I listened to Howard Stern's interview with Hillary Clinton, which he took a shot at Bernie Sanders. And, yeah, you're right. Who wrote that? Party Unity, who wrote that?
Good old Babbers.
Babbers, yeah. And Babbers has a point. Party Unity apparently only goes one way in my beloved Democratic Party. And Bernie people, are supposed to shut up and go along. Well, when's it going to work the other way? This is on my mind, some of the comments that Hillary Clinton made about Bernie Sanders. Cannot get over to 2016 election, Jacob. Can I get over it?
It's ridiculous.
It's just will never end. You would think they would come together and just say, you know what, for the best interest of the Democratic Party and the country against Donald John Trump.
She shouldn't comment. Don't even talk about it. How's that helping Democrats at all?
I don't know. It keeps that alive. So yes, Babbers, I'm going to be weighing in. You got any more updates, D? Before I take
once again, everybody, on Tuesday we're back on YouTube. So make sure to join us if you're watching on Facebook Live.
All right. The last time Jacob Kaplan was on the show was pretty funny. We were talking about this. I can't remember. It was over a month ago, and the show ended. Then Jacob's phone went off, and he goes, I got to leave, and I got to go.
Yes.
Lurie Arroyo Gate was breaking out, and Jacob's executive director of the Cook County Democratic Party, and Lurie Arroyo, of course, a former state rep, a Democratic committeeman. I want to say, oh, gosh, I'm going to do this off the top of my head. He was a Democratic committeeman from the 36th Ward.
Correct. Still is, technically.
Still is, technically. So then the issue was, would he remain as committeman of the Democratic Democratic committee of the 36th Ward, even as he stepped down as state rep, in which case he would have a hand in determining his successor. And I guess the assumption we had when the show began, Jacob, is that no, he would not. You got the phone call as it was like every reporter in town was calling you. Yep. I had you in the studio.
I know. Breaking,
you were like, I got to go. When you ran. So it's a month later. Talk about Arroyo Gate.
Well, he didn't step down. And so this was the question was, since he resigned as state rep, there were 30 days in which to replace fill his state rep seat. And as committeeman of the 36th Ward, he had a large share of the vote to do that. And he unfortunately did not step down, even though Party Chair Preckwinkle, the entire executive committee, called on him to resign. But we unfortunately have no method to eject him from the party. So those votes were cast ultimately for the candidate that... that he wanted. And, he wasn't there in person, but he gave a proxy to Committeeman Ariel Raboris. Mm-hmm. And those votes were cast for candidate Eva Dina Delgado. And, after that happened, the Speaker came out and the Governor came out and said that this candidate shouldn't be seated by the House. As far as I know, when the House reconvenes in January, there's probably going to be a hearing held and she may be ejected from the House. So the whole process is just, it's pretty distasteful, and I don't understand why Louis thought it was a good idea to go. Well, I'm not going to speculate on why Louis decided this. Obviously, he's got other issues right now. But in any event, it made everybody look bad, including the party. Even though we called for him to resign, our hands were tied on the matter.
And Raboris, it couldn't have happened without Raboris joining in. I mean, again, it's a weighted vote, and Arroyo didn't have enough votes on his own to determine a successor. So he needed a confederate, if you will, a partner, if you will. And so Ariel Raboris joined in. It gives me a lot of stuff to talk about and laugh and roll my eyes, but it just does make my beloved Democratic Party look bad.
It does.
I want to point out, even Proko Joe Moreno's votes were cast.
Proko Joe Moreno, now he's still the committeeman of
the first ward.
By the way, and we're going to talk about committeeman. Is he running for re-election?
No, he's not.
Okay.
But he gave his proxy for his votes to Iris Martinez. So she voted, State Senator Iris Martinez was in the meeting and voted for this candidate as well.
Okay. So. Well, Proko Joe weighs in.
Yes.
Funny. He gave a Rage Against the Machine album to Ben.
Yeah, there you go.
He came onto my show. He loves the 90s. Proko Joe Moreno loves the 90s the way I love the 70s. And he gave me a Rage Against. Was it the album? No. He gave me Negatory. He gave me a Rolling Stone magazine with Nirvana on the cover.
Oh, I thought he gave you a record.
Maybe he did that too. I don't know.
Our host never remembers.
I'm old, man. All right. So let's get into some of the committeeman races. Some of the more noteworthy ones, since it's relevant again. Jacob, explain what the committeeman position is and its importance and significance in Chicago Cook County politics.
Sure. So, and actually, the name was changed, so now it's technically Democratic committee person. We helped pass legislation a year ago to make it gender neutral. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the committee person is the Democratic leader of their ward or township. So all 50 wards in the city of Chicago and all 30 townships in suburban Cook County elect a Democratic committee person, and the job of that person is to help turn out Democratic voters in their ward, be the head of the Democratic Party, vote at slate making when we get together to endorse candidates, vote when there are vacancies in office for state representative, state senator, and some other offices, and generally be the head of the Democrats in that area. Historically, they were very, very powerful positions. When this was the quote-unquote Democratic machine, as some people still love to call it. But, you know, back in the 60s and 70s under Richard J. Daley, they had all the control over the patronage jobs in the area. That's not the case anymore, but they're still positions that people like to hold, and they're very, very down-ballot positions. Literally, in the Democratic primary coming up, this will be the last thing you see on the ballot. After all the judges, all the state reps and senators, then you get the Democratic committee person at the very bottom. Mm-hmm.
And it may be at the bottom of the ballot, but as we see, they have a significant role to play in things like, most particularly, vacancies. So in this case, where Louie Arroyo stepped down as state rep, the rules of the game are such that the committeemen convene, or the committee persons convene, and decide on a replacement. Now, let's just talk about that for briefly. How valuable is that designation as a replacement? We're early December. People have just filed to run for a March primary. So the replacement that Proco Joe Moreno and Louie Arroyo and Ariel Robles decided to replace Arroyo with will only be a quote unquote incumbent for 2 months. Before the March. So how valuable is that designation?
Well, in that case, I don't think it's valuable at all. I think it's toxic. I think, considering the fact that Arroyo's votes were cast, I don't see why anybody would want to be appointed, especially because they're likely to get kicked out of the House. And how are you going to run for office saying I was the one expelled from the House of Representatives? So I don't think in that case it's valuable. Historically, it is valuable. It gives you a bit of a leg up. You know, you're the incumbent, so you can say I'm the state representative, I'm the state senator when you go door to door. Which has led some people to say that, you know, these are insider deals and we should switch to special elections for legislative seats. But the cost for special elections and the fact that you maybe get 15% turnout, if we went to that system, I'm not sure that's a great system either. So this is what the what has come up with and how things have been done since the 1970 Illinois Constitution.
Yeah. All right. So committee person is a valuable position. What are some of the more unique races that we have to look forward to, some of the bigger battles coming up in the March primary?
Well, there's the one that goes on every single cycle. This will, I think, be the third time. That's in the 12th Ward, where Alderman Cardenas is running against the incumbent committeeman, State Senator Tony Munoz, for another rematch.
Wow.
Munoz keeps beating him, but he keeps coming back for more. So that's that'll be another epic battle. Another race that is pending is in the first ward. That's an open seat because Proco Joe Moreno, as you said, is not running again. So there you've got several candidates. You've got the new alderman, Daniel Espada, running. You've got the candidate backed by Proco Joe and the first ward organization, Jay Ramirez. And then you've got another candidate. Andy, do you remember her name?
I can't remember her name.
Yes, you've got another.
She just kind of came out of nowhere, from what I can tell.
Yes, you've got three candidates in that race, which is wide open. Mm-hmm. Now, historically, what's happened is when a new alderman wins and they run for committeeman, they almost always win that, too, because they're brand new. They have the name ID and all that. So my bet would be on Lespada winning that race, but anything's possible.
Hey, Joe Moreno still had, $500,000 in his campaign fund? He could throw all that behind Jay Ramirez to grab this spot.
Has it ever happened, and this is total geekdom, has it ever happened that an alderman was defeated in an election for committee person?
It's happened.
That meter's going off again. Oh, my God.
So one of the interesting ones that happened is a incumbent alderman being kicked off the ballot for committeeman in the 35th Ward. Ray Colon was kicked off the ballot
correct.
For committeeman.
I forgot that. Ray Colon.
Yeah, and then he lost his race for alderman in the next in the next cycle. So it's never a good sign if you get kicked off the ballot as an incumbent.
Yeah, particularly if you're a party position.
Yes.
You're supposed to have mastered the rules and the regulations governing ballot access.
Yeah, and actually last time around, Proco Joe Moreno came within a couple hundred votes of losing for committee members.
Yeah, that's right,
Maria Teresa Gonzalez.
Yeah.
So I don't know of a case where an incumbent alderman has outright been beat. It's probably happened, but it's very, very rare.
And it's,
so
what would be rare, to your point, is when you have a newly elected alderman and that person comes in with some momentum. I recall Sue Sadlowski-Garza, for instance, in the 10th Ward. She got elected, really hard-fought battle, beat John Pope in 2015, I want to say it was. They were counting ballots forever, and she was finally eked out this very slender win, Jacob. And then, boom, next year she just ran for committeeman and just clobbered whoever. I don't even know if Pope ran for re-election.
I think they put somebody else
up. He put somebody up, and she clobbered him. It's just a consolidation of power. People get used to a certain name. Oh, you know, Sue Sadlowski Garza, she's doing a good job. I'll vote for her for committeeman.
Yeah.
Or committee person, yeah.
Exactly.
You know, I want to mention, though, from just the plain old regular voter's standpoint, these filling of the vacancies, obviously the political class certainly thinks it's valuable, because I read there was a Sun-Times or Tribune article that put out there that certainly more than half of the current state legislators were originally appointed to their positions. And I think that it's not so much about the cost or anything. It's that it does have a chilling effect, right? When you put somebody in that's now an incumbent, even though they were never elected and they never put their name on the ballot, they never had to go door to door. You put that name out there as the incumbent, all of a sudden people that might pop up and go, oh, I'll take a stab at this, they go, it's just not worth it.
Well, now let's talk about that. A lot of people running. Which district is it? The Arroyos district?
Third district.
Let's just take a look at the third district. So I'm going to count right now how many candidates filed. 1, 2, 3, 4 candidates running, all as Democrats. Eva Adina Delgado is, quote unquote, the incumbent. Again, she was voted in by the committee persons of committee people. But it's Speaker Madigan says he's going to challenge her and keep her from being seated. So we'll see how that plays out.
Well, and that's a special case, right? I mean, to Jacob's point, that one is one where the votes that put her into office were toxic or viewed as toxic. So I think that the people coming up behind her are going, well, this is not an incumbency that's helpful to her. It's going to hurt her.
Well, now one of the arguments, Jacob, that you made in the past, you and Danny Pogoshelsky, is that in the last few years we've seen sort of this alignment between progressives and old school machine style. I put machine in quotes because I think everybody's as soon as somebody gets elected, you're in the machine, folks.
That's what everybody
but whatever. Machine is a word that gets tossed around a lot. Sort of come together in certain races, running against ROM type candidates. So. Are we seeing in any of these races anything resembling like a battle between the Hillary and Bernie forces on a local level? Is that being played out in any of these races?
I think it's too early to say who's with who presidential candidate-wise and whether it's going to play into committeeman races, because they're kind of obscure. I mean, one of the interesting ones, maybe where it will, is in the 40th Ward. That's where Pat O'Connor's not running again for committeeman. So the new alderman, Andrew Vasquez, is running. He's a Bernie delegate. Or Bernie supporter. I think he's a delegate. If not, he's definitely a strong Bernie supporter. And then you've got Maggie O'Keefe, who ran for alderman last time around and lost, but got a lot of votes. She's running for committeeman as well, and I'm not sure who she's supporting for president. But that's a ward where I could see the presidential race playing a key role, you know, depending on where things line up. But in general, I don't think that presidential races really impact committeeman races too much, at least not in my experience.
So in other words, well, I wasn't even specifically talking about this presidential race. I was talking more generically about this, like the divide between
the progressives versus
centrist divide, which is alive in this presidential race. Hillary Clinton's name's not on the ballot, but you could talk about it in terms of Joe Biden / Mayor Pete / Amy Klobuchar versus Bernie and Elizabeth. I mean, that's kind of the general divide. So are we seeing that kind of general divide in the Democratic Party?
I don't think so. And I think most of the committeeman races that are appearing this time are more like personal, just I don't like you, so I'm going to run against you type of situations. I don't think there's so much ideological, at least that I've seen.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about some of the other races that people really worth noting in that are coming up in the March primary. And what legislative races do you really think people should be paying attention to?
Well, certainly the third district's going to be very interesting. I think you're also going to see an interesting race. I believe it's the 12th district. That's the Sarah Feigenhold seat.
Yes, on the lakefront.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting because there you have, of course, Senate President Cullerton is retiring. So the assumption is that State Representative Feigenholz is going to get appointed to his seat, and then that leaves her state representative seat wide open. And this is the district that represents Lincoln Park and Lakeview and is a very, very a lot of very engaged political activists in that area. So there's a lot of people running for that seat. That's definitely going to be one to watch.
All right, let's talk about if the Bernie-Hillary schism isn't there, there is, of course, the remnants of last what was it, last April's mayoral election. Lori Lightfoot is the mayor. Tony Preckwinkle, of course, is the chair of the Democratic Party. Your boss is in charge of the Democratic Party, or is the chair of the Democratic Party. Are any people who are running running in terms of that divide, like I'm a Lori candidate or I'm a Tony candidate, or is that not at play in this election?
I'm not seeing that so much, at least not yet. You know, and I think Lori and Tony are going to be on the same page on some things, like, for instance, Kim Fox. You know, they're both endorsed Kim Fox and are heavily supporting her, and so are a lot of the other elected officials like Dick Durbin. So I think I'm not sure that you're going to see a Lori-Tony divide in any of the races coming up, at least not that I've seen.
All right. But by the way, Kim Fox, I think I said the last time we were on the show, put your money in Vegas. No way she's losing this election.
I hope you're right, Ben.
No way.
Yeah.
And this gets into a larger issue.
You don't think Bob Fioretti is going to give her a run for her money?
Come on. Bob Fioretti, my old friend, and I say that. You know, before, who was it, the Facebook follower who was asking me about Nick Sposato?
Ricky.
And Ricky, the same thing goes Sposato as Fioretti. I have dealt with these guys when they were aldermen, and I said this before, Bob Fioretti was very helpful to me, some of the TIFF stories I did. So I have this, plus Bob Fioretti, and it's a long, complicated story. He helped me get an autograph from Bobby Hull, the great Blackhawk, the Golden Jet, but that's a whole other story.
So you're voting for him for that reason, right?
No.
Do you have anything to do with Jay Doherty?
No, George. I will can almost guarantee I would not be voting for Bob Fioretti for state's attorney. But I do appreciate the role he played in all these stories they did, and the fact that he was willing to stand up to Mayor Rahm and Mayor Daley at a certain point. So I'm not going to throw people under the bus, Jacob. That's just not how I operate, you know, just instinctively. But that said, Bob Fioretti, Bob, what are you doing?
I think he wants to run for every office that's ever existed in Cook County or the state of Illinois. He's run for mayor 2 times, state senate. He ran for county board president. I mean, he's literally trying to run for every office possible. It seems like it. Maybe he wants to make a record, you know?
Well, the guy likes running. Leave him alone.
He likes running, yeah. But I just can't see, and this gets to the larger story, Jacob, that Mayor Pete seems to be incapable of understanding, that black people get to vote. And, you know,
you don't think 0% in South Carolina is going to help him?
No, Mayor Pete, you're talking about, no.
Yes.
And so, so all when Smollettgate erupted, many Democrats saw Kim Fox as vulnerable, and just the nature of Smollettgate and how it's played out with Donald Trump championing the fight against Kim Fox, with the Fraternal Order of Police championing the case against Kim Fox, with the fact that Kim Fox has stood up for alternative sentencing. She's a black woman. I mean, it's just the nature of politics in Cook County and Chicago. Immediately I knew she would be widely supported throughout the black community. He would see the obvious case of double standards have been applied here, where everybody's hard on her, but they were easy on Anita Alvarez when it came to prosecuting Daley's nephew. And it's playing out that way. You got all these white guys running against her.
Including a billionaire.
Which billionaire?
Conway.
Oh, Conway is the son of a billionaire. And
it's a transitive property.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's like, do people ever learn? You don't understand? You cannot win a Democratic primary without black votes. It just seems like I'm going to prove. Even Bob Fioretti, my beloved Bob Fioretti, is right. I'm going to run with the police support. That's not going to get you elected in Cook County.
I think you're right, and I do think Kim's going to win. So but it's not going to be an easy race for her. I mean, there's you know, this Smollett thing has blown up, and you know, unfortunately, that's become, the media just loves going after her on things like that.
I'm guilty in that one. I've been all over. I stand accused. I'm guilty. I've spent a lot of time talking about Smollettgate.
But Andy, I'd be curious, just as a neighborhood resident in Logan Square, what do you hear on the state's attorney's race?
You know, Logan Square, particularly lately, is famously progressive, right? It's progressive to the extent that when you guys were talking about the presidential divide, I was like, wait a second, Joe Biden, he's still running? Because I haven't heard anybody say anything good about him. But I think that, with the exception of our host, I think that, in truth, I think that the Smollettgate thing, unlike the way that the Ed Burke story, right? You could harp on that Ed Burke story for months and months and months, and it did enormous amounts of damage to, like, Tony Preckwinkle, for example. I don't think Smollettgate is... I don't think it rises to that level. I think that the sort of Hollywood angle made it very sort of tiring, mm-hmm. right? Unlike Ed Burke, where everyone's like, oh, yeah, I know my alderman, and the whole city's so corrupt, and this is terrible, and then there's this actor, right? Some actor that... perhaps three-quarters of the people haven't heard of who did something, who the heck knows. That's not going to impact.
Well, I'll give you the player who's turning Smollettgate into an advantage for Kim Fox. His name is Donald Trump. Donald Trump bashes Kim Fox with Smollettgate. In the Ed Burke case, Ed Burke represented Donald Trump. So the most unpopular politician in the city of Chicago is Donald Trump. Ed Burke was his property tax lawyer. That's how arrogant Ed Burke was.
Yep.
Oh, I just keep getting elected representing the guy that Hispanics, blacks, progressives, all cannot stand. I won't say hate. Hear that, Ramona? I cannot stand. That was another discussion. So that's the fact that Donald Trump has weighed in. It's helpful and useful to Donald Trump, because it helps rally his base. But it's certainly not helping the Republican Party get a state's attorney elected in Cook County if Donald Trump is weighing in on behalf.
No, and I don't think the Republicans can win another countywide election. I don't see it happening anytime in the near future anyway. So I'm not worried about. I know there's a couple of Republicans challenging Kim, but I don't see that being an issue. I should also mention when we were talking about committee person races, Ed Burke has two challengers and he's running again for committeeman. That's two challengers, so that's going to be an interesting race to watch.
Ed Burke running again for committeeman.
Yep. Yep.
Wow.
We asked him to resign, but he's running again. So,
what can I say? That's interesting. Yeah. No, but I'm interested. What's going to happen? What do you read the tea leaves? Where's that going?
I don't know. I mean, so initially, Aaron Ortiz, who's the new state rep in that area, who beat Ed Burke's brother, Dan Burke, for state representative, is running. And then all of a sudden, a Latina is running as well. So, and purportedly, she has some ties to Burke himself. So I think he's trying to split the Latino vote in the classic Chicago way. Yeah. I don't know if it's going to work or not. It's, obviously, he was still able to win re-election for alderman handily. So I don't know what's going to happen here, though. This is a Democratic primary, different turnout, so who knows?
Now, what are the access rules to get on the ballot for committeeman? How many signatures do you need to your...
It depends per ward. Funnily enough, in a lot of wards, it's more than aldermen. So in some wards this time around, it was as many as 1,200 signatures. but 14th ward is a lesser turnout ward, so it was probably somewhere around 500, if I had to guess.
Okay, so my suggestion to everybody who's curious about this race, and I'll do it, look and see who challenges who. Then you'll have an indication of who's supported by Ed Burke, who's not supported by Ed Burke.
Challenges will be filed on Monday. So
So what is the percentage? Just so I know, what percentage is it? A percentage of the turnout in the last election?
Yeah, it's a percentage of the turnout in 2018, and I'm not sure what the percentage is, but that's how it's based. It's based on the percentage of Democrats that turned out in the last election.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to impeachment, and I'll throw the question I've been throwing to absolutely everyone, and I'm looking forward to having this conversation next week. At greater length, with Marge Halpern, who's going to be in the studio doing a bonus interview. She's doing a lot of work in the surrounding states to try to get, like, Michigan to go from Republican to Democrat in the presidential race. The issue of impeachment, purely from a political standpoint, Jacob Kaplan, let's put aside from a legal standpoint, let's put aside the case against Donald John Trump and the fact that he's wants to be the emperor, not the president. Let's put that aside. Political. There's a lot of consternation on the part of Democrats. Some of them saying, I don't know if this is going to help us in Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania. It's going to work against us. It's going to make Donald Trump a sympathetic character. Nancy Pelosi herself was very slow to join the bandwagon for impeachment. She's in big time now. What's your general sense as a party animal, how this affects the Democrats?
I mean, I think it's something I think it'll be a positive for us. I really do. I know that, funnily enough, I don't know if you saw this on Twitter yesterday, Trump's 2020 campaign manager tweeted out this poll from a congressional race in Oklahoma, one of the seats the Democrats had won in 2018. I believe it was Oklahoma. and saying, see, look, this poll shows that Democrats are, you know, impeachment gate is tanking them and they're not going to win. But this poll had impeachment in that congressional district, I believe 45% of people thought that Trump should be impeached. So if that's the argument the Republicans are going to make, that in a district that's pretty conservative, that still that many people think the president should be impeached, I'm all for it. I mean, I think it's a must, you know, morally, but I also think that it will help us. I think that if we didn't do it also, I think that a lot of Democrats would be seriously deflated and a lot of the activist base would honestly disappear. So I think it's a must on that account, too, just for the Democratic base. But I don't think it's going to hurt us that much, even in swing congressional districts in the Midwest. I don't really see that happening here. I could be wrong.
I didn't see that tweet. I'm going to go back and look at it. That poll, 45% favored impeachment. Do you remember what the rest of the poll was?
I don't remember what the horse race was in the congressional race.
No, what I'm saying was that 55 were against impeachment, or was it more one of those things split? 20% didn't know what they were thinking. 10% had no opinion whatsoever, that kind of thing, or you don't remember?
I don't remember, but whatever it was being roundly made fun of in Democratic circles just because it's like, why would you release this? It's not a good look for the Republicans.
All right, well, then I'll put this question to you, and Andrew, you can weigh in as well after Jacob weighs in, and this is the David Ferris point. David Ferris, a political scientist, comes on the show all the time. I think he's one of the smartest political minds around in the city of Chicago, and he has always argued that Democrats should play the game of politics the way Republicans do, hardball. None of this namby-pamby of Barack Obama, when they go low, we go high. Oh, there's bipartisan. Yeah, Joe Biden, I'm talking to you. Because there's no such thing as a bipartisan Republican. It hasn't been in the last 10 years. Let's be honest. Democrats, stop being suckers and saps. And David Ferris's argument, which he's made in the show many times, is that Democrats should carry out this impeachment fight throughout the entire calendar year 2020, even if it does not get to a vote in the Senate, even if it gets tied up in contentious lawsuits that Donald Trump files to keep the Democrats from having access to his aides and documents, etc. Even though each one of these cases goes to the Supreme Court, drags things out. David Ferris's argument is we should continue this fight because it just makes Donald Trump and the crimes of Donald Trump the centerpiece of the 2020 election battle. I wholeheartedly support him in that. Not everybody agrees with me, Jacob Kaplan, believe it or not. There are some Democrats that say, Ben, you don't even know what you're talking about. This is going to work to the Republicans' advantage. Let's get this over with fast. What's your opinion?
I tend to disagree with you, actually.
Go ahead.
I think it's important to get it done with some expediency, even if it means that not everything is included in the articles of impeachment because certain people won't testify or what have you. I don't think it's a good idea to string it out forever through 2020. And then I do think that opens up Democrats the argument that, oh, they're just trying to do this for totally political reasons. And I don't know. I think it's good to get it over to the Senate because I think, number one, Trump is going to implode when he's impeached. I think that despite the fact that he says that he doesn't care if he's impeached or not, I think that when this happens, I think he may do something crazy. And I also think when people are actually testifying under oath in the Senate trial, I think some interesting things may come out of that that are maybe even more explosive than we've seen so far. So I think it's important to get this articles of impeachment done, voted on, and get it over to the Senate for the trial. But I could be wrong.
All right, Andrew Schneider, you're the deciding vote. Do you agree with me or do you agree with Jacob Kaplan? Don't buckle under pressure.
I can I take a middle ground? Is that possible?
Go ahead.
I think that everybody's sort of looking. There's no question; it's a political process, completely political process. Yeah. And so the question is: no matter what, whether the Democrats are fast or whether they drag it out, they're going to be subject to this. Is just a political witch hunt. It's just a witch hunt. I think I would. If I was forced to make a decision, I would go with Jacob and say the thing to do is to move it with some speed to the Senate, and largely because I don't think that he's going to be thrown out of office, but I do think that the Democrats, the problem I have with the way they're approaching it is I think they're all sort of weighing in their hearts and heads, the leadership anyway, is that Trump is a very useful enemy, right? I had somebody, I was having a fight in our neighborhood group, and a guy asked me out to coffee, and I went and met with him. But Bruce, good old Bruce, my neighbor, said, look, don't be too friendly with him. He's a really useful, like, cartoonish enemy. You need that guy, right? And I think that that's a part of the Democratic calculation for the next presidential cycle is just, look, we have this cartoonish villain as president. Right? Yeah. I mean, how can we get a better... Now, that's the same calculation that Hillary Clinton made in 2016 to all of our sorrow.
No, and this is where I'll disagree with it, because I've been thinking a lot about Hillary Clinton ever since I listened to the Howard Stern interview. And there's this underlying assumption that was so profound in 2016. And I guess it's more Michelle Obama saying, when they go low, we go high, that the Democrats were above Donald Trump. And I never felt as though Hillary directly engaged Donald Trump. Maybe my memory is faulty, but the one thing that sticks out in my mind, Jacob, is when the debate happened and it was that Donald Trump was walking behind Hillary Clinton and he was just breaking all the rules of civility that are supposed to occur in a debate, disrespecting her opponent, like literally invading her space, and she ignored him. She had to know about his presence behind her, and he ignored. And I always felt that the Democrats in 2016 either try to dismiss him as a funny caricature, didn't take him seriously, didn't get down in the mud with him, were above all that. And I feel as though that is a lesson that they should learn, that that's not how you deal with Donald Trump. I don't know. Is that your memory of the race as well?
I think so. I think we didn't take him seriously enough. Democrats didn't take him seriously enough early on, that's for sure. But neither did Republicans. Yeah. So I think that's certainly the case. I mean, in terms of Hillary not engaging him, I mean, maybe that's true. But, you know, certainly my mind goes back to the debates. And I think she, you know, everyone would agree she won those handily. But maybe there should have been more. I don't know. That wasn't Hillary's character regardless. And that's one of the reasons I'm worried about Biden. I know you like Uncle Joe, and if Uncle Joe's the nominee, I'll happily vote for him and support him. But I'm worried that if he's the nominee, he's going to try to play that same tack that Hillary did and not really take it to Trump and try to treat this like a conventional campaign where it's like, I'm the normal guy and he's crazy. Yeah. But you can't really run that way.
Allow me just to clarify my position on Uncle Joe. Just to be ideologically, Uncle Joe is to the right of where I am. I just don't have the disdain that some of my younger friends and guests who come on the show have for Uncle Joe. I don't know why. I probably need psychological help on this issue. Some of the stuff he does, I don't know, in a weird way. Like the thing when he nibbled on his wife's finger. It's just like...
Oh, you like that, huh?
It's just kind of like,
big fan.
Wow. He's just a weird guy, you know? I mean, I don't know. Anyway, I do have a weird thing for Uncle Joe. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to add while we're talking through... I think that one of the things that Democrats didn't understand, and I think that this is something that's true broadly of the political class, whether that's here in Chicago or Washington, D.C., is that a good chunk of America has been struggling financially and otherwise for decades, right? Decades. And so when you have people like Hillary going, well, things are objectively better. Like, look at all these numbers. I got a chart. They're better. And a good chunk of America, you're not speaking to their experience, right? They're saying, hey, we've all been cheated, right? We're all being cheated. Yeah. Everybody's taking advantage of us. And you have Donald Trump going, oh, yes, by the way, did you know that Jacob Kaplan's uncle's brother's fifth cousin participated in the JFK assassination? Everyone goes, aha, yeah. I knew it. Yeah. I knew it all along.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a big part of this problem is people are primed to believe the absolute worst about what happens in Washington and downtown Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I know I'm pretty much primed to believe the absolute worst what happens in downtown Chicago. All right, let's call. Wait, you have an update
before
for me?
Before we roll out of here, first off, I knew that about your relative.
Oh, boy. Sorry.
I knew that.
Best kept secret.
I knew that. Well, first off, Donald Trump needs to weigh in here.
No collusion.
Oh, thanks.
No collusion.
Of course. Yeah.
That's what he said. All right. Three things before we get out of here. First off, right now, posted on, well, it will be on the Bendrovsky Show Facebook page very shortly, but it is at ChicagoReader.com. It's the latest Chicago Reader column from our very own Bendrovsky. Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit about it? It's about Harold Washington.
Oh, my God. You'll love this, Jacob. Well, it's actually, I wrote this around Thanksgiving. And I was just feeling so much, I guess, nostalgia for Harold Washington because he died, I think, the day or 2 days before Thanksgiving in 1987. But what got me thinking, I've said this already in the show once today, is that people tend to view Harold Washington is in the terms of the racial conflict in Chicago politics. And they don't look at the larger ideology of Harold Washington. And he was very much a leftist. And he very much, and the comparison, I said he was Bernie Sanders before Bernie Sanders. And, you know, he was opposed by all the white aldermen and the white committeemen in the city of Chicago and Cook County. And so he became an icon in black liberation politics and black empowerment, et cetera, and so forth, a very important icon, but lost track of the fact that ideologically he was a New Deal Democrat, leftist, Bernie guy before Bernie. And I feel as though, I just was thinking about that, there we've lost that connection between black political empowerment and lefty politics to a large degree in Chicago these days. And so that was just some reflections I had on Harold Washington and the role he played. And that story, I happen to say, a lot of people, they weighed in on it and were, they, well, the, you know, like a lot of people agree with me. Usually I get people weighing in, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, but not so much in this case. Anyway, that's what I was thinking about. You're a Harold Washington expert. I know you weren't alive when he was around, but you've studied
2 years
him.
Old.
You were 2 years old. Okay, sorry. 2 years. Yeah. But do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I totally agree, and I think that's the part of his, you know, so many people, as you said, want to view it as just a black versus white, you know, period where there was all this infighting and racial, you know, differences, but I think he really was one of the most progressive mayor we had, certainly probably in the city's history.
History of Chicago.
And people gloss over that again and again. I mean, with his neighborhoods agenda and with everything he did with, I mean, just you name it, he was more progressive than any mayor we've ever seen. So I think that doesn't get enough attention. So I'm glad you wrote that article.
Yeah, no, I wrote that. And just to tie him to, like, for lack of a better term, the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party. All my Elizabeth Warren listeners go, Ben, what about Elizabeth Warren?
So go check out that article. Yeah. It's Ben's latest, Washington's Lessons, it's called. Just search for Ben Jarofsky, Chicago Reader on Google, and you'll find it. Let us know what you think, by the way, on the Ben Jarofsky Show Facebook page. All right. Also, 3 bonus interviews will be available for you to download over the weekend. We're talking all things Donald Trump with Jim Coogan.
Yep. Lawyer Jim Coogan, we're breaking down all the legal aspects of the impeachment. Again, take a deep dive. Talk about the nerd meter going off, but Jim Coogan knows his stuff, and we really take the deep dive, a lot of the legal implications. And we also do some William Barr talk. Jim Coogan's excellent when he breaks down what Attorney General William Barr's.
And who are the other 2 bonuses?
Well, we haven't done the 3rd one yet. Patrick Whalen will be coming in. And Flint Taylor. This is a fascinating story. Flint Taylor is a lawyer. He was the lawyer for the estate of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader who was killed 50 years ago. Good God, am I getting old? I was around when that happened. And Flint Taylor does a great job of breaking down the story behind the lawsuit that eventually led to a settlement for Fred Hampton's family. Man, I'll tell you what, folks, just the lying and the deceit and that was at play between the leaders of Chicago, Mayor Richard J. Daley, State's Attorney Edward Hanrahan, the FBI of J. Edgar Hoover, President Richard Nixon. It's a compelling story. So Flint Taylor, I think we're going to drop that one tomorrow, Dean.
And finally, we're back on YouTube starting Tuesday. Just want to remind everybody, if you're checking this out on Facebook Live, you should join us on Tuesday at the Chicago Sun-Times YouTube channel. Subscribe to that channel now, and on Tuesday, you'll get the alert. And Ben and I's beautiful faces for radio will be joining you on YouTube. So we're back on YouTube on Tuesday.
All right, very good. Thank you, Andrew Schneider. Thank you, Jacob Kaplan. Thank you, Ramana Hussein, early in the show. And, of course, the man, the myth, the legend, the pride and joy of Alton, Illinois. And as Andrew Schneider knows, back home in Alton, they call Dr. D White Lightning. Give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. See you Tuesday, everybody.
Hey, and remember, you can download previous Ben Jarofsky shows and those Benny J. bonus interviews I was talking about at both Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Reader websites, chicago.suntimes.com, chicagoreader.com, and wherever else you download your favorite podcast. Downloaders, we live stream this program. And I know I just said it, but we will be back on YouTube on Tuesday. Once again, Chicago Sun-Times YouTube channel. Go check it out. Enjoy those bonus interviews. We'll see you Tuesday.